Well, we'll try to begin then. Let's turn to chapter 12, verse 10 through 20. Hello, Mr. Cohen, how are you?
I'm still looking for it.
We're on page 18. Thank you. Yes, please. Well, we have here the, in 10 verses, a rather remarkable story. Remarkable because somehow it disturbs the whole picture we have of Avraham Avinu. And if you read it carefully, objectively, without trying to overlook the distasteful parts, you remain with some kashas, some real difficulties. Vayidov Baaretz, there was arose a famine in the land, which means in Canaan, where God had sent Abraham to through a Lech Lecha. Vayered Avraham Mitzrayim al Gurishem, he went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was grievous in the land. And verse 11, it came to pass, when he came near to enter into Egypt, that he said unto Sarai his wife, Behold now, behold now, I know that thou art a woman of handsome appearance, point the English of King James. And it may come to pass, when the Egyptians shall see thee, that they will say, This is his wife, and they may kill me, but thee they will save alive. Say then, I pray thee, thou art my sister, that it may go well with me for thy sake, and my soul live because of thee. Was that a fair arrangement? What's going to happen if he says that she is his sister? So him they won't kill. What about Sarah?
They won't kill her, but they'll take her, of course.
So. Because he was hungry, he went into a land where they may take her from him. It's a puzzling problem. What was this reason for this?
Although you said.
Well, let me add a few more questions before time to the answers. You know, there's a whole school of philosophy called neo-Kantianism, which is based upon the idea that a good question is worth more than an answer. So let's try to formulate the questions first. The answer doesn't matter too much. And it came to pass when Abram was coming to Egypt, just what he said happened. That the Egyptians beheld the woman, that she was very fair. The princes also of Pharaoh saw her and commended her to Pharaoh. And the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. And he did well to Abram for her sake, just what he said, it shall go well with me because of thee. And he received sheep and oxen and he asses and men servants and maid servants and she asses and camels. All is looking good. But the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, What is this that thou hast done unto me? Why didst thou not tell me that she is thy wife? Why saidst thou she is my sister? All the questions we can ask, Pharaoh asked. And so I took her to me for a wife. Now therefore, behold, here is thy wife. Take her and go thy way. And Pharaoh commanded some men concerning him who accompanied him and his wife and all that he had. En passant, I'd say that, as Asfarno points out, you see something here about Egypt. That Egypt isn't the most moral country in the world.
It's not the most immoral either.
Why not?
Because Pharaoh at the end said, if I'd known it was your wife, I wouldn't have taken her.
No. Wouldn't he? He said so. We wouldn't have taken her and kept him alive. But he certainly would have killed him to take him. This seemed to be common procedure. Abraham seemed to have known these Egyptians very well. And obviously it was
Then why did he give, what Pharaoh give Sarah back to his Abraham?
Oh, because by Nagash and his pile, he had a vision of God, which when God told him, you're getting this this punishment because you're discussing Abraham. You're handling with a man who is dangerous to you. Let him go. But it's the kind of country where Pharaoh had commanded his servants every time they saw someone who was handsome of appearance that the press to notify him and forcibly to take this woman into his harem. This is the kind of oriental despotism that was regarded as standard normal practice in Egypt. So it was not a very moral country. Now, Rashi has some interesting, very interesting comments. The verse in verse 11, that now I know that thou art handsome of appearance, a handsome woman, is ad achshiv v'hikir v'mitot tziyah shebeneim, that until this moment he actually didn't know if she was beautiful or not. The famous Rashi, you want to know just for the principle of tzniyus, of modesty, which it teaches. And now he recognized that she was handsome, and the story was that they passed, going into Egypt, they passed over a body of water, and he saw her reflection in the water. Another medrash agada states that ayidei torah haderech adam mizbazeh vezos amda biyofya. He commented that she was beautiful because generally when people are traveling and going from place to place with all the dirt and grime and tired of travel, the day you might add because of the changeover in time when you never get any sleep one way or another, people don't tend to look their very best. And he saw that despite the great traveling, she did look her best, that she did look very well. Therefore, he commented that hinei lo yodati ki ishi yafas marad. More important, the pshat, says Rashi, hinei na higia hashar sheyesh lido la yafya. He says that until now, you were beautiful, it didn't make any difference to us practically. But now it does make a difference, because now we're going amongst people who are nashim shchorim u'mechorim, acheim shel kushim. Standards of aesthetics at that time, and not much change today. We're going amongst people who are black-skinned and also ugly. They are the brethren of the Ethiopians or Sudanese. Kush actually is someplace in the Sudan. V'lo hurgulu b'ishe yafa. To them, you will be a great, an outstanding beauty, and they just simply are not accustomed to this. And therefore, I know that this will cause us a great deal of trouble. The next Rashi is even more amazing. L'man yitav li barvorech, he says that I want you to lie and say that you were not my wife, but what? My sister. What is the purpose? L'man yitav li barvorech, it should be good with me because of thee. Well, the pshat, the literal meaning is good, is simple enough. What does it mean? They won't kill me. Right? If you lie, at least I save my life. Rashi, following the Medrash, says something else which is not understandable. Yitnu li matonos, they'll give me gifts. What kind of business is this? Is he trying to sell his wife's honor for gifts? This is Abraham? What does he mean? What does that actually mean? I want you to come with me to Egypt, don't tell him you're my wife, in order that they should give me presents as a result. This is not the Abraham who later was able to say to the king of Sodom, I don't want anything you can give me. Just save my brother-in-law, and I wouldn't take even a shoelace from you. This is the Abraham who wouldn't accept any gifts from anyone. If he was going to go into Egypt, into this kind of country, risk this kind of tragedy in his family, all because of presents. The whole thing sounds very unusual. This, of course, is the main point that I want to discuss. I'll come back to it in a moment. Let me just go over the next piece of Rashi. It's very interesting. When they came, Vayehi kavo Avram Mitzrayimah, verse 14, as Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that she was beautiful. So the rabbi said, why as they came to Egypt? Kavo Mitzrayimah, kavo Avram Mitzrayimah. Payalomar kavo Mitzrayimah. It should be as they came to Egypt, Abram and Sarah. Why as Abraham? They came together, didn't they? How, what would the normal style be? The normal style should be, Abraham speaks to Sarah about the plot, and then it was when they came to Egypt that the Egyptians showed the saw that she was beautiful. Why did he say that when he came, when Abraham came?
He has a sister, she traveled alone.
No, they didn't travel. It's a good guess, but he says something else. Lomei shehit minos habeteva. He actually hid her amongst his belongings. He simply acted as if he's coming by himself without his wife. Because they demanded beauty on the customs, which was, it's an ancient practice. They opened up the baggage. They took aside his belongings, took off the cover of the camels, which was of course loaded. So it was as he came that they saw her, because they began to probe and they discovered his great secret. The interesting part about the gifts, of course, is one that is very troubling. And the Kli Yochar, one of the commentators with great insight, points out that when Abraham said that they should give him gifts, number one, he wasn't really aiming at getting gifts. He said that if they know that I am your husband, they will simply kill me. If they think that you are my sister, then they'll try to bribe me into permitting you to marry Pharaoh. In that way, at least, they won't dispose of me too quickly and I stand a chance of survival. It wasn't that he wanted the gifts. It was simply describing what would happen. They're going to give me gifts. Well, why would they give him gifts? In an attempt to bribe him into permission to give his sister as a bride to Pharaoh, when they thought it was his sister. But Kli Yochar points out something much more interesting. You recall when Abram is at the very end, after the Akedah, what does he do? Does anyone recall? You remember the B'nai Keturah?
He gave gifts.
Yes, very good. He gives gifts. To whom does he give gifts?
To each of the children.
To the children. Which children?
His children.
To the B'nai Apalachim, doesn't he?
Yeah.
The B'nai Apalachim. I can't find it. It's here someplace. He gives gifts to the children. Well, the B'nai Apalachim doesn't have Ram Matanos. Abraham gives gifts to the children of the Palakshin, to the B'nai Keturah. Who is this Keturah? Why does he give them gifts? The whole thing seems to be a sort of non sequitur. The Torah is telling you about a story, and in the middle, the Torah gives you a story. Then he gave them gift before he died. Well, and so? Does it have to outline for me then the gifts too? This one he gave the grocery store, and the other one he gave the AT&T stock. And what is...
But this is in connection with the Yitzchak. He gave everything. He gave his son Yitzchak everything.
He gave his brother.
So
why? So what is important to tell me that? Who has to know it? I mean, the Torah tells me only the significant. There's an economy of words in the Torah.
Is it perhaps because he received presents from Pharaoh, he wanted to counterbalance?
Very good. Now you're all right. Now whom did he give? Who are the B'nai Abdullah? Who is his Pilegesh? Who is his concubine?
Hagar.
Who was Hagar?
Egyptian.
That's it, an Egyptian. So he never wanted to enjoy the benefit of these gifts he received from the Egyptians. He knew that he got them wrongly, and he wasn't going to enjoy. He was going to give them back to the Egyptians themselves. And so at the end, the Torah tells us that he gave gifts to the B'nai Apalachim, reminding us of this story when he received gifts from them. Abraham says, in effect, the Torah tells us, in practice, very subtly, what Abraham in the middle actually says to the king of Sodom, as we'll read later, Ve'al tomar ani he'eshar di es Avraham. Never shall you be able to say, I made Abraham rich. He didn't want to have any handouts from anyone. And so as soon as they gave him, when they gave him the matanis, he remembered it, and later on he gave it back to an Egyptian too. So he should be free of the stigma of having taken what, to his moral consciousness, seemed tainted money. The question is, was he right or wrong? Should Abraham, in the whole story, no, giving it back, of course he was right. Was a high moral act. But the whole story we've read here, does Abraham appear right or wrong? Rashi, of course, would seem to indicate that he was right. That you cannot blame Abraham for anything. It's an important point. When the very first verse, verse 10 says, Va'ido Abarz, there was a hunger in the land. And Rashi says, "Be'osa ores levada." All of the Near East had plenty. Only in Canaan, to which Abraham had been sent by God, was there famine. Lenathosa, it was a form of trying him. Im yaharher achar dvarash v'kodesh baruch hu she'amal ala lachas ala eretz kanaan v'yachshav masiyah ala tzeisimem. It was a matter of testing to see how firm Abraham's faith was, because here Abraham had just been told, to leave war of the Chaldees or Akkadim, to travel to this land. Once he comes there, famine. He's got to leave again. So the question was, would Abraham begin to doubt as a result? Would he begin to question as a result? The very fact that he didn't, but he left without questioning, without fighting fate, but confident in the Ribbono Shel Olam, according to Rashi, is a tribute to Abraham. If you want to increase, well anyway, that is Rashi's point of view. But does everyone say so? The answer is no. The Ramban happens to be very strongly against Abraham. In fact, he expresses himself in rather sharp words. As a matter of fact, you don't normally find the Rishonim who speak that sharply against a person like Avraham. I'd like to read you a very small section to show you how very sharp it is. Just one moment, I'll be there. V'da, he says, ki Avram avinu chota chet kadol b'shgaga. Abraham sinned a great sin in this entire portion. Shehevi ishto hatzadekes b'michshal ovan. For having allowed his wife to be put in a position of sin. His wife was a tzaddikus, was a pious, righteous person. Because he was afraid that they were going to kill him. Avram here, he says, showed weakness. He rather should have had faith in the Ribono Shel Olam, that God would save him and all that is to him. He said, the same God whom he trusted to come to this land, he can trust to take care of me, even in famine. So the Ramban is being rather severe on Abraham. Because of this act of Abraham, Nigzar al Zaro Hagolus. The Eretz Mitzrayim Biyad Paro, remarkable. Because of this sin, says Ramban, the Jews had to go into Golus in Egypt. You frequently ask, why was it necessary for the Jews to have this long exile, this long bitter exile that we celebrate on Pesach before they became a people? And the Ramban says it is a direct result, a punishment of Abraham for the whole story of his involvement with Pharaoh. Because he lacked the moral stamina not to go to Egypt, and going there he came with under a ruse, with an artifice, and fooling Pharaoh on top of it. Therefore his children received the punishment of 410 years of exile under the same Egyptians because of this complicated or complex sin committed by Avraham Avinu. And he answers, B'makom, quoting here, if you recognize the verse from Kehelas, B'makom ha-mishpat shomo ha-resha v'ha-chet, in the place of judgment, there is the place of wickedness and sin. The place where Israel was judged and tried, which means Egypt, that is the place that they originally sinned, Abraham, and therefore his children received this punishment. So the whole Pesach Seder is appropriate. It came because a man didn't have the, according to the Ramban, because a great man didn't have the guts to see through a situation without sacrificing and without fear.
Yaakov asked the permission before he went down to Egypt.
Yes, it's true. Yaakov had a similar circumstance and he asked permission first. It's very true.
I heard that the reason was that the Jews had to, that Abraham's offspring had to spend the time in Egypt was because he had asked at the time, God said to him, I'll give you this land. He said, he wanted a proof. He said, how will I know?
That's regarded as a sin, but not as the reason why. In other words, that's regarded, there are two points of view. One said he was Baha'u'llah HaMidosa Shal Kodesh Baruch Hu, he questioned, therefore. Yeah. But actually, this is the most satisfying explanation. If you're willing to accept that Abraham was guilty, this explains it in a pattern. The sin took place in Egypt, the crime, the punishment, took place in Egypt. Actually, I don't know if I would want to be so harsh in Avraham Avinu. He's speaking about a man who is a towering moral figure. You want to say he sinned, say he skipped Mara Sunday, but you don't say he put his wife in that kind of compromise. It's too much to accuse Avraham of, even though the Ramban is willing to take that kind of sharp, rigid attitude towards Avraham, a strict attitude. It's a question. Now, you know, a similar incident happens on page 29. The story with Abimelech. Now Avram goes again, the same story over again. this time it's not Paro Melech Mitzrayim, it's Avimelech Melech Gerar. And what happens when Avimelech gives him the argument, why do you tell me she's your sister? What is the answer? Verse 12, Begam Amnachos, Ibas, she is my sister. A half-sister, it's permitted to marry a half-sister from the father's side. Achlo Bas Imi, but she's not my sister from my mother's side. But the Hili Leisha, she became my wife. So when I told you she's my sister, I wasn't lying. You asked me then, why did I use a ruse, an honest ruse, to get out of it? Well, people are going to take a man's wife or a man's sister without her will and coerce her into a harem. I'm allowed to use an honest form of deception. There's nothing wrong with that. Furthermore, the great Jewish Egyptologist Ben Yehuda, an article in the yearbook about 9 or 10 years ago, I noticed it, has an article about this whole incident of Abraham and Paro and Avimelech. He points out something else, that the answer that Abraham gave is only one answer. There's also another answer that's perfectly evident if you know Egyptian culture. And that is that the pharaohs and all princes and noblemen, especially the pharaohs, whom do they marry?
Their
own sisters. So much so that the term sister became an equivalent of wife. And where do you have proof of that in Tanakh? Precisely, in Shir HaShirim. What is it? The lover speaks to his beloved, and what does he call her all the time? The endearing term, Achosi, my sister. So even into poetry, it filters down later from what was originally an actual practice. The marriage of sister, and frequently, incidentally, the marriage of mother and daughter too. Incest was part of the Toeva of Mitzrayim. Part of the Toeva of Mitzrayim. And therefore, when he told the Egyptian, or the Gerarian here, that she's my sister, they may have said, well, you as a Canaanite, or as Avram, as a Canaanite may mean literally a sister. But Avram said, no, I was speaking your language. I said a sister, I meant in your terms, which means my wife. So that it was a form of honest deception, which evidently was practiced by Yaakov too, occasionally, in order to get out of a bad situation in which he was placed. No outright lie, but simply saying words which have two meanings, and using this to be able to get out of the situation. Now, something is fascinating about this whole story, and the Ramban points it out too, and after meeting one certain modern commentator, Kasuto. Look at the story of Avram. Where are we now? Chapter 12, yes? Mm-hmm. You can go verse by verse, you see something very fascinating. Start at the top of page 18. And then turn to 43, verse 1. Now look at top of page 18, the first three words. The whole sentence, and then look at the first sentence of chapter 43 on page 74. Do you notice the similarity? By he of Boris, there was famine, and Abram went down to Egypt to live there, ki kaved ha-ra of Boris, because the famine was grievous. Page 74, and the famine was sore in the land, and it came past when they had completely eaten up the provisions, and so on and so forth. The words sore and grievous are the same in Hebrew, kaved. So that the reason for Abraham going to Egypt is now the reason for whom to go to Egypt. The Bnei Yisrael, the children of Jacob, to go to Egypt. Again on page 81, verse 4, when they turned to Pharaoh, why did they say they came to Egypt? Ki kaved ha-ra'av be'eretz Kanaan. They repeat the very same words with which the story of Abraham going down to Egypt occurs. On the previous one, what does it say about Abraham? There was hunger in the land, and what did he do? Vayered Avram Mitzrayim lagur sham. And what do you see in verse 4 on page 81? Lagur ba'aretz banu. The same language, the same verbs are repeated. Because of the hunger, we've come to sojourn in the land. Verse 12 in our chapter, page 81, what does he say? And it shall be when the Egyptians will see you, Va'amri Ishtuzaus, Va'amru Ishtuzaus, and what will they do? Va'hargu osi, they will kill me, Va'osach Yichayu. And what do you have in Shmos? What do the Egyptians do? In Benhu Vahamitem Noso. Recall what comes next. The Embassy Vachaya. The exact same language. Abraham is afraid that they will let you live and they will kill me. And what Abraham's children, when they come to Mitzrayim, what do? They kill the boys and they allow the girls to live. The parallelism is continuing. And why did they come to Egypt? Because of the famine, the same as Abraham did. And then the killing, they kill only the men, not the women. The same problem that Abraham faced. Sarah is taken to Abraham's, to Pharaoh's palace, and his great-grandchildren are taken to Pharaoh's cities as slaves. In the same situation as she would have been taken as a slave woman, as a part of the harem. We read here about the matanos and the gifts, all the things that Pharaoh gave Abraham as a gift. And what happens with Mitzrayim after the period of slavery? They take everything with them. They are not still with Mitzrayim. They take along pots, pans, silver, gold, diamonds. So the story is repeated. You notice how the whole outline of the story comes true. Pharaoh, does he get away with anything here? No. Vayanaga Hashem es Pharaoh. Negorim gedolim. He plagues him with all kinds of plagues, him and his house. Right? Do you have anything similar to the Egyptian story? Of course. Dan Sradeya Kiramaro. The 10 plagues. In chapter 13, verse 1 here. Vayal Avram Yimitzrayim Hu Ve'ishto. Which way do they go? Hanegba. Into the south. How do the Jews go? Vayalu Banegev, as soon as they leave Egypt, they go to the south. Vayelech Lamasa Ov, we have here, verse 2, and Abraham went on his journeys, Minegev ad Bezel, and then throughout all of Shmos, Vayisa'u Yisrael Lamasa Ahem. The same verb. They went traveling and on their journeys. So what principle do we see? The story is a remarkable parallelism. Do you feel it? You see the same verbs, the same story, the same outline, almost point by point. So that the story of Abraham, Sarah, and Pharaoh is a kind of capsule of Futurama on a much larger scale, on a national scale instead of an individual scale. Instead of taking 10 days, it takes 400 years. But it's a pre-projection of the entire episode of Golas Mitzrayim. So that this seems to be the perfect example of what principle?
Maase
Avos Sima Levonim. The fact that the story that happens to the patriarchs becomes a pre-capitulation, instead of a recapitulation, a pre-capitulation, so to speak, or a sign of what is going to happen later on to the Bnei Yisrael, to their children. Well, what are the reasons for this principle? For this prefiguration, is the word really I'm looking for, of later Jewish history. Actually, there are two reasons. Number one, to show us that the Golas Mitzrayim, the exile in Egypt, was not a historical accident. Because you can study history two ways. You can study it as an exercise in probability, an accident, fate and destiny. You know the word, the Yiddish word, sebashert? This is very un-Jewish. It's very un-Jewish. Or you can look upon it as something which was the unfolding of a divine drama. And when you know that the story was prefigured in the times of Avraham Avinu, then you no longer look upon it as fate, or as accident, as destiny, but rather as, again, a divine intelligence which directs the unfolding of the story. If you want proof, look. It happened before to show you that this is the way in which God works. Second, it also was a message of hope for the Bnei Yisrael. The children of Israel who were caught through these 400 years is about how many generations? About 20 generations, isn't it? The normal span? 20 generations of Jews born and died in this slave labor camps. That is a very long time to be in Golos without any sign of a Yeshua, any sign of salvation, living in the lowest the lowest level. Still with my old vocabulary, the lowest level of society. So when they realized that the entire story had occurred to Abraham, to their great grandfather, they knew an end must come. That just as Abraham and Sarah were able to leave the clutches of Pharaoh before them, so they will do again. Frequently Jews say nowadays, or they did before, the state of Israel was bad. Well, we survived Haman, and we survived Paro, we'll survive Hitler too. It's a, you know the famous story of surviving Haman, don't you? Can I ever tell it to you? About the Yeshivnik, the Jewish farmer, the provincial farmer, who had, he came home one day, and he was very downcast, very depressed. So his wife asked him, Mushki, what's the matter with you? So he said, I'm very worried. Why are you worried? He said, I planted my corn, I planted new wheat, I bought a new horse, I invested in a new wagon, I put so much money into my farm, and what happens if Mashiach comes tomorrow? We'll all have to go to Israel. I will lose my entire investment. So she was very sympathetic, commiserated with him, and said, Zorzachnish, don't worry. But Shinduchaleb Toman, Meduchaleb Paran, Meduchaleb Mashiach. So we'll survive Mashiach too.
But then,
Rabbi,
go
to
the time, was for sure, if you want to use that word. Wasn't it?
If
you were already preordained,
pre-figured
out, and there was no choice,
The Golos was Mashiach. But the Golos, in the sense that they went into Golos, but they already found themselves in Golos. But to say that I must remain in Golos endlessly, this is my fate, that you can't. Even in the word Basher, it has a fatalistic tinge to it. It means my dumb fate. In other words, in the Greek sense, that it has been preordained and nothing you can do. You can move heaven and earth, but you can't get away from your fate. It follows you around blindly, like a missile seeking out its target. Wherever you go, it's going to follow you. But this is not the Jewish conception. The Jewish conception is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu goes there, Betzadik Mekayim, or Betzadik Mevatel. Reverse. The HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God can decree, but a righteous man, certainly a righteous community, can violate the decree and negate it. In other words, that whereas
God changes his mind.
No, God allows man to change his decree. God can plan an outline of history, but he always does it contingent upon the behavior of man. The whole idea of Mashiach in the Jewish conception is that Mashiach will come. When he will come depends upon us. If we go along our wonted ways, he will come in his own good time. If we are at another level, he will come earlier. On a higher level. That is the way Chazal explained the words in Isaiah. Ani Hashem, I am the Lord. What should you remember the rest of it?
The Ita'ach
Yishena. I will hurry it, which means the end, the redemption, in its own time. The question is, if you hurry it, it's not in its own time. And if its own time, it's not hurried. So they said that God here meant to, the prophet here means to show us that God gives us the alternatives. Either Be'ita, either it will come in its own time, in which case it will be a time of utter destitution, which describing the eclipse of the Mashiach, which means people will be down and out spiritually, economically, and every other way, or Achishena, or I'll hurry it up, which means you'll be deserving of it. So that the coming of Mashiach, the coming is Basher, in that sense. When is up to us. All of Jewish history leaves a large area where a man can determine his own destiny and his own fate. Under such conditions, you can't call it Basharat anymore. It's rather up to us. Now, the entire story of Abraham and Sarah is important for another reason. So he didn't take Sarah. So Pharaoh lost his prize, and he had to frustrate his own passions. Why is the whole story important in addition to this? Rabbi Soloveitchik points out that throughout the story of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, you have a constant emphasis on marital life. You ever notice that? Constant emphasis on marital life. It seems that every argument Abraham and Sarah had, the Torah records faithfully. I mean, would you want in your biography to have every one of these things recorded? I'd be embarrassed to death. But with Sarah and Abraham, every time they had a little spat, the Torah goes into whole details, and usually Sarah comes out winning. It's the worst part of it. With Yitzchak, disagreements with his wife, he had problems with his, most of all, she couldn't have any children, and they had to wait, they had to beg and pray and plead, and again, difficulties. When they had children, more difficulties. Yaakov, his domestic life was certainly certainly complicated, agonizing, till he marries, he gets the wrong girl, another 7 years, and she can't have any children, she has to wait. So this one can't have any children, the other one is has a tragic life because she has children, but she doesn't have her husband's affection. So the whole history of the patriarchs, of the Avos HaUmah, is filled with this pathetic element of family life and this emphasis on it. And Rabbi Soloveitchik maintains that actually the whole story, the whole thread of the domestic relations of the Avos is simply background material leading up to what we call Hilchos Isurei Bia, or Hilchos Ishus, leading up to as the background for the laws and principles of Jewish marital life. The principles of tznius, of modesty, the principles of morality, and the principles of geder arayis, of keeping, of kedusha, of keeping away from all kinds of immorality. All this is really hinted at and prefigured in this story. After all is said and done, Abraham didn't have to go through all these convolutions here. He could have said, look, she's my wife. It's a matter of my life or my wife. Take my wife. I'm sure that there were many people in those days who were given that alternative would have responded that way. Yet, you find that the purity of the family and the purity of the yichus, not in a sarcastic sense, but in its original sense, the whole line of Jewish development was kept in tahara, in purity. Sarah was not violated, neither now nor in the next story with Avod Avimelech. She remained loyal to Abraham. Rivka, they had to suffer until they had a child, which means that when they had one, they appreciated him all the more. You know, what is achieved through great difficulty, you're all the more grateful for. It happens in every phase of life. So that the whole portion of Jewish history that is related to the Torah is really background material for the portion of Kedoshim, which tells us of the Jewish principles of morality. And the Jewish principles of morality in their turn reflect the story of Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, showing us that this is not dry law that is being legislated from on high, but this is merely a codification of a way of life taught by your own ancestors under the guidance of the Rabbanu Shel Olam, who had singled them out and whom they had acknowledged. So that this becomes an extremely important thing. Of course, it's important today too. Frequently we don't realize how this is one area of life which today is extremely an extremely delicate situation. First the whole attitude of morality in America has undergone a very radical change. I must have mentioned it someplace recently. A recent article. Oh yes, this past Shabbos I mentioned. In the pulpit. This, the latest issue of commentary. Does anyone read commentary here? You admit to it? I do too. I must always know what the opposition thinks. Did you see the article by Paul Goodman?
No.
Read the article by Paul Goodman. It's hair-raising.
Is that the United Synagogue?
No, American Jewish Committee. American Jewish Committee. Published an article by Paul Goodman in which he advocates the abolishment of the category of the pornographic and the obscene, because since you have a law against obscenity, people want to be obscene. Therefore, abolish the law, they won't be obscene. It's like saying about all laws, since people violate the law to murder, abolish the law not to murder, so they won't murder. It's an anarchistic principle, and one that reveals a certain hashkata, a certain rot at the very core of modern life. And especially the core of Jewish life. This is a.
Well, I think the law of moral laws and the pornography and that sort of thing is. It only injures the person who comes into contact with it himself. But when a person steals from someone else, he's actually hurting someone else. In the other case, he was hurting himself, so I think the two aren't exactly the same.
Well, how about the peddler and the smut?
Well, that I think is wrong.
Well, that's the point. But you see, the law is not against the individual who reads the book, but against the one who distributes it.
Oh, right.
Yes. That's the primary problem. And he's not speaking, mind you, against old fogies who think that, to read a Shakespearean sonnet, which is not absolutely prim, is verboten. He said that even the courts that vote in favor of James Joyce or vote in favor of this other trash, what is it? Unexpurgated. What are they?
Lady
Chatterley, which should be a passé already from a literary point of view. That even they who permit it are wrong, because they're merely saints interpreting the law to permit it, where they should abolish the whole law. This is the extent to which the modern mind has become corrupted. I say it in the full sense of the word. I'm not ashamed of it, to use an old-fashioned word. When Roman civilization, incidentally, was in this death throes, it also experiences libertinism. It seems that every civilization, as it's about to die, becomes very, not only liberal, but libertine. Not liberal. Libertine. It is, well, to me, this is a sign of a cultural rheumatism, at the very end of its life. It may be. But from a Jewish point of view, we face other problems. Problems of Gittin and Kedushin. In other words, a person may be mentally very, very right and very righteous. At the same time, if he isn't aware of the halakha, he sometimes can get into serious problems. Very simply, reform have abolished loyalty to Jewish marital law. Now, what happens if a reform couple wants to part? They get a civil divorce. And she goes, and on the basis of a civil divorce, the wife marries again. According to the halakha, it's an adulterous relationship. She can have the best intentions. She's living a well-intended adultery. And the children? Well intentions, but they're illegitimate. And the stain of illegitimacy is not a thing you can banish by a dispensation from some Jewish pope. It's there. And it goes from generation to generation. Well, this sort of situation is also a destruction of Jewish family life. And that's why it becomes an extremely important thing to be aware of. And a great deal of Judaism, the whole story of Bereishis, is built upon extreme caution with regard to this kind of existence of the royal family life. When you finish this story, the very next thing that the Chumash covers is the story of the covenants. Again, a very important part of all of Bereishis. We'll come back to the kings later on. Incidentally, just look at chapter 14, verse 13, verse 18. Avimelech was Malki Tzedek, rather the king of Shalem, which later became Yerushalayim. Hotzi Lechem V'yayim, brought out bread and wine, and he was a Kohen Le'el Elyon. What does El Elyon mean?
Was that their chief god? Yes.
You see, he had reached the highest stage of paganism. He recognized that amongst all the gods that he served, there is one god who is above all the other gods. When he will have reached the highest stage, he will have removed all the sub-gods and said there's only one god. And therefore, when he blesses Abraham, he is gracious and he adds the one thing that he couldn't say for himself, but that Abraham did say, next verse. And he blesses him and says, Baruch Avram Le'el Elyon. I also recognize the El Elyon, which means the chief of the pantheon, the chief of the whole gallery of gods. But your God is Konei Shamayim Vares. What? The one who acquires or creator of heaven and earth, which means the one God. So he identifies in a form of a hospitable gesture. He identifies his chief of the pantheon, his El Elyon, with the one God of Abraham, who is Konei Shamayim Vares. Baruch El Elyon, and blessed this highest God who has given over your enemies in your hands. Well, when it comes to the covenants, you have a number of major covenants. In the Torah, there are a certain number of times that covenants or bris is mentioned. The two of them with Abraham are which bris? How would you term them? How would you call them? There's the bris ben habsarim, right? That is the covenant between the pieces. Shishi, that's chapter 15, verse 7. We'll come to it in a moment. Then there is the bris milah. And then there is what?
The shibboleth.
What?
The shibboleth.
I'm sorry.
Shibboleth.
Well, that's the bris milah is with Abraham. Then finally you have Torah. Torah itself is a bris. Torah itself is a covenant, and that's why it's called Sefer HaBris. Oh, is it warm in here? It's the Book of the Covenant. Now, in order for us to understand what bris means, incidentally, you have to have certain presuppositions, certain hypotheses. What would you say is the first hypothesis of the idea of bris? The first principle before you speak of bris.
God exists.
There has to be a God. Otherwise you can't have a covenant with him. What else?
There has to be a man.
Well.
Who accepts
the
God or has a connection.
Obviously. Come further. No.
Well, God has to have some sort of relationship with this man.
God must be, in other words, how would you call it?
Personal God.
To believe in a God who is merely an immanent principle, or simply is an idea or an abstraction, a God who is immersed in himself, an Aristotelian kind of God who has no relation with mankind, which is deism, can a God of this sort have any make a bris? Obviously not. He's too busy thinking of himself. You know what Aristotle's God does all day? What does Aristotle's God do? You're taking the philosophy course, though.
I guess he watches the universe.
No, nothing of the sort. What does he do? Drinks liquor?
Nectar?
No. Aristotle was too sophisticated for that. Aristotle's conception of God is that God is the highest perfection. Now, the highest perfection means that he's changeless. In Greek thought, simplicity, perfection, and changelessness were identical. So for him to observe the universe would be no good, because the universe is low, it's changing. If it's changing, it's rotten, it's no good, it's imperfect. So God, to have imperfect thoughts, is a dent in his perfection. So he couldn't even think about this universe. So what does he do? He thinks about what is that which is most perfect. What is most perfect?
Himself.
So he thinks about himself all day. I mean, all through all eternity. So God is a self-thinking God. God thinks thoughts of God all day long. A very egocentric Rabbi Shalom, not even Rabbona Shalom. A God who does nothing but think of himself. Well, with a God of this sort, you can't seal a covenant. A God who is only a philosophic abstraction is not our God. The God of Israel is a God who reveals himself, who observes, who cares, who is concerned, who comes down to man, who raises man up. But he's involved with man, he's engaged with mankind. All of history becomes an unfolding of the story, of the tensions and the loves and the distance and the closeness between God and man. When this is your conception of God, when this is the reality which you accept as God, then you can have the idea of a bris. Because the bris actually is one of the most important ideas, the fact that man and God can meet. And not only can they meet, but man can bind God as well as God binding man. Because don't forget, in this bris, not only does man commit himself to God, but God in turn commits himself to man. So it's a remarkable idea. And before you can speak of a bris, you have to have a Jewish conception of God. That's why our friends two houses away, when they have a bris meal, I think it's a joke. I think it's merely a hygienic procedure. But to call it a bris milah would be actually a desecration, or words are emptied of their meaning.
Peoplehood,
yeah, but why hurt the poor child because of peoplehood? The whole thing doesn't make sense. The idea of bris has no relevance.
Well, I like tradition.
Yes, if they would, if they would say, if they would say we're doing this nini buchan amizuma to do this, the shame sentimentalism or Jewish people, could I be satisfied? But you know, when, once you lose the central idea of all of Judaism, everything else is empty. What does prayer mean? Who are they praying to? I'm saying this in the full openness. I would not give the same argument against, let's say, our Reform friends.
To who would they concern?
This is the old story. Who would they concern? But even that's ridiculous. Because actually, what is God to them? The whole, this whole dualism or pragmatic conception? God is a principle within ourselves. So if I say, blessed art thou, O Lord, I could reinterpret that to say that means blessed on me. Right? Well, praying to oneself, normally if one does that and he's observed by the authorities, put it in Bellevue.
Narcissist complex.
What's that?
Narcissist complex.
Yes, it's a form of narcissism, or religious narcissism. Very good.
It's a form of self-infection.
Yes.
Freak again.
You're praying to
the yourself. Yes. You've got to observe it rather than pray to it. Now, the entire story with the Brisbane Hapsarim is rather interesting. What does it consist of? So take verse 9, 15:9. The object, actually, or rather, before we do this, what happened before this? Before the Brisbane Hapsarim, chapter 14 tells us a long, long story. The story of four kings fighting against five kings, and somehow Abraham gets mixed up into it, and he goes out and tries to and fights, and he beats the king of Sodom and Amorah, and he takes Lot. The Lot had been captured, his nephew Lot had been captured by the king of Sodom. Then they come and ask Abraham to do what? To rescue him. He does, he comes, he rescues Lot. That's the time that we pass that Melchizedek presents him with the bread and the wine and blesses him. And then the king of Sodom says to Abraham, give me the people and take for yourself all the loot. And Abraham says to the king of Sodom, by no means, I won't even take a shoelace, he tells him, from whatever you have, so you'll never say that I made Abraham rich. All I will take is expenses for having to feed the army that I got to save you. Otherwise, I won't take a penny from you. After these things, now let me ask you another question. Why is this story important for us? He won a war. He probably had 1,000 scraps of that kind.
I think this is to show, to the detriment of Avraham, he took men who, I think tradition says that these men were Talmidei Torah, their students, and he sent them into fight.
Yes, there is a medesh about that effect. But that would explain one small incident. From the larger view, from the point of view of Pshat, what is the importance of this whole thing? You know what the answer is? If you look at the border of this battle, you find that Abraham had now conquered Eretz Yisrael. He had taken title by winning the war against the five kings on the behalf of the four kings. It's a war that he won. What he actually did was, and the king of Sodom offered it all to him, to take all of what later was to become the borders of the land of Israel. So that Abraham has here historic title, the Eretz Yisrael. And what happens in the chapter following, the Bris Ben Hapsarim, the first covenant, is that what he had acquired historically is now affirmed by God. But Abraham first acquired normal, historic, natural rights to the land, and later it was to be confirmed by the Nevi'im Shemot. Now, as I'm saying, in this interesting bris, what does he do? God says to him, verse 9, take me a heifer 3 years old, she-goat 3 years old, a ram 3 years old, turtle dove and a young pigeon. He took them all these, divided them in the midst. In other words, he cut each body in half and laid each piece one opposite the other. But the birds he did not divide. And then the bird of prey, which means the vulture, came down upon the carcasses, but Abram drove them away. And then you have the very rare thing in the Torah, a description of the prophetic experience While the sun was about going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and lo, a horror, a dark and grave fell upon him. In a few words, you have the depth of the soul-searing experience. And he said unto Abraham, know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger, the land which is not theirs, and so on and so forth. Basically, what does God promise him here? That Israel, doesn't it? And also a nation whom they shall serve will are judged, and afterwards they shall go out with great substance, and they will come back, in other words, and take this land. This is the Haftachas Ha'aretz, that they will have the land for themselves. So why the splitting of the body? What did it all mean? What is the symbolism involved here? What's going on? Joseph Albo, who was one of the last great of the medieval Jewish philosophers, explains it as follows. He says, what is the concept of bris? What is bris trying to show? Well, when people make a covenant with each other, what are they trying to indicate? It's more than a bargain. Now. What then is it? Yes, what kind of relationship? A very close relationship. They're as one, they become as one. Their personalities merge. They come together. They become as one. That, says Albo, is indicated by this. Splitting the bodies and walking between them, showing that just as two halves of the body, each is dead without the other, and only when they're together do they live, so are both parties of the bris. Without each other, they are lifeless, and they come to life only when they're together.
Why did he divide birds then?
What's that?
Over here, why not? You know, because they took them all these and divided them in the midst and laid each one off together. But the birds he did not divide.
Very good question. And that is a disproof of Alma. Yeah. Alma
doesn't
mention
this. Next commentary.
Yes, the next commentary is Ben El Jacob, a modern commentary. A very good question. This seems like a perfect answer, except that why did he divide the birds? The Ben El Jacob, a German Jewish commentator, man with great insight, maintains that he doesn't know why they split them, but he does know why they split them. He says, because how many generations of Jews were to stay in Egypt? Well, 20. I'm going by the normal reckoning of 20 years. But if you take the two, I was an error. I just realized it now. It was 200 years, I kind of 400 years. That was my error. So it's left, yeah, it'll do. In my error, I don't know why I said 400. But if you take the number of generations who are still alive and who died, you have three. Because they lived, they reproduced early, but they lived longer, 120, whatever it might be. And you have about three generations in these 210 years. Now these three generations who were born and lived in Egypt were in Golos. The fourth generation saw freedom. Who tried to destroy their freedom? Egypt, that was pursuing them, right? This, he says, is the symbol here. Three animals are three signs of slavery. They were split. And finally, the birds. The bird is a symbol of what?
Freedom.
How do you say a swallow in Hebrew? Little bird, a fly is free.
The
drawer. And what does drawer mean?
Freedom.
Krasim drawer b'chol ha'aretz. Doesn't mean you shall proclaim a swallow, it means you can't proclaim liberty throughout the land. Because the bird, having the ability of flight, is a sign of freedom. We like to take wing and just get out of a mess, you see. Get out of whatever situation we're in. The bird is a symbol of the fourth generation, is a symbol of freedom. And the ayat is the vulture is whom? Egypt. Egypt would have destroyed the bird, but Abraham wafted away. The schus of Abraham, the fact that the children of Israel are the grandchildren of Abraham, is what saves them.
It's not because the bird is one of the two signs of Egypt. The bird and the snake, I think.
Perhaps the vulture.
Vulture
and the snake.
The snake, are the two signs.
Honey. Yeah, so they even worse, but I didn't realize.
What about all these animals being 3 years old?
If I know more about animal husbandry, perhaps I'd be able to give an answer. But being fairly well unacquainted with the fact.
Is an Israel compared to a dove?
Yes, it's sure, it's sure. It's always compared to a dove.
So that's the reason why it wouldn't be split.
Well, yes, but it's more than Israel would. wouldn't be split because this is the time that Israel comes into its own, that it makes the attempt to leave slavery and to proceed to freedom. So that this is the symbolism you can see in this particular bris. Although I would not say that the remark of Albo is to be negated entirely. He doesn't succeed in explaining the whole story, but the idea certainly is a good one, and one that indicates the depth of meaning involved in the whole concept of bris. Now, if you go on from here to Mila, what does Mila tell you? What is the what is the bris Mila tell us? The continuity of the Jewish people. The fact that the people will continue and survive. Basically, Mila itself is not so much a bris, it is a bris, but it's more what? Mila itself is a sign of a bris. In other words, you don't perform the bris during the time of circumcision. It's merely the os bris, it's merely the symbol of the fact that the child is being introduced into a pre-existent covenant that exists between the Israelite people and the Ribbono Shel Olam. But the symbol of the bris came primarily to assure Abraham that when the Saticha Legoyim Umalochim Emchay Yitzeyu, that he would be the father of a people who would survive and live forever. So in addition, the first one he promised him he would have his own country. Then, that it wouldn't be merely a temporary affair where he gives him the country and takes it away from him, but rather that his people, his children or descendants, would survive and would populate that country and be the Amma Olam, the eternal people. Interestingly, in the middle, the story is interrupted. By what story? Chapter 15. 16, I mean. The story of Yishmael. The story of Hagar and Yishmael. Which is a thing we have to come back to and try to understand Sarah's point of view. She seems very harsh. But nevertheless, Yishmael is a man who was Ba'asher Husham, a man who evidently is a wild person. And what does he do? One second. Now, what I'm asking is, what is the business of Yishmael in between both prisoners?
Another nation?
Another nation, yes. I think primarily to show that Yishmael is not the fulfillment of the promise of Zerah. If the story with Yishmael had come after the Bris Mila, then Yishmael would have had a claim to being the rightful successors to Abraham, the rightful heirs to the bracha of Abraham. But Yishmael was born before God promised that to Abraham. Therefore, the promise had to be chal, had to occur, had to involve something which was not yet real. He promised him children. But why promise him if he has one? Evidently, this child is not the one with whom the promise of the succession of Abraham's spiritual mission, his spiritual destiny, would be realized. And therefore, that means only Yitzhak and not Abraham. The Bris Bein Habsarim, as it can be interpreted, is not only a bris between God and the people of Israel. The Bris Bein Habsarim, to an extent, is also, for us, a covenant between ourselves as a people and the land of Israel. The land of Israel, there's a certain loyalty through this bris of the people to the land. In this sense, Zionism is not an invention of Theodor Herzl. Zionism is the invention of Bris Bein Habsarim, because the relationship of Am Yisrael to Eretz Yisrael is formed here in this portion of the Torah. You know, the Medrash points out on the words V'hashimosi es sa'oretz in Lamentations and Kinos and Eicha rather, that the prophet Jeremiah says that God storms against Israel and says V'hashimosi es sa'oretz, I will how would you translate Hashimosi? I will make the land, I will empty the land, I'll destroy it utterly. So the Medrash has a very remarkable expression. It says Zu Mida Tova. It's not only, you may take it completely as a curse, but not completely. To an extent, it's a good sign. It's a promise. Why? She'ein ha'oyvim nehenim mimena benetayim. Because it means that the enemies of the Jews will not be able to enjoy Israel in between.
Nobody has.
And nobody has. Stop. Nobody has. They try to. All of you were in Israel and you go as tourists. What do they show you? Napoleon's fort and the Turkish aqueducts, but they never got any nachas from it. The Kaiser, during the big centuries of colonization, the Kaiser tried to colonize Palestine too, didn't he? What city did he build? What part? The Sharon. But he never succeeded. The Sharon is incomplete to this day. Somehow, Eretz Israel kept up its loyalty to the people of Israel. So that the foreigner, the Oyev, never had a chance to exploit it. The land never submitted to foreign hands. It remained loyal to Klal Yisrael, even as Klal Yisrael has over 2,000 years remained loyal, basically, to Eretz Yisrael. The question is, what does this loyalty of the people to the land really mean? Does it mean merely building a country in the image of Moshe Dayan? I mean, is this what Abraham dreamed about and God promised him? We'll have a child called Moshe Dayan Amin, and this will be the realization of all years of dreaming, praying, bloodletting. Obviously, there's something more than merely building another state. I mention that because on the way here, I stopped off to visit someone, and they had him on television. But there is something more than this. Obviously, the loyalty of Am Yisrael to Eretz Yisrael means also to that which is unique in the land of Israel and the Torah of Israel. Eretz Yisrael must represent a certain uniqueness, a certain yichud, something that is characteristically itself and utterly different from anything and everything else. And that which is unique in Israel is not merely a political structure. Important as that may be in the real world, that is not the unique contribution of Klal Yisrael, and that to which the people of Israel have remained loyal throughout the ages as a sign of the Bris Ben Avsara. Bris Mila, as we read in the same portion, is L'Doroseichem L'Achuzas Olam. We are told that the same Palestine to which we were promised would be L'Doroseichem for generations to come, La'achuzas olam, as an eternal heritage of Klal Yisrael. Now, what is the name in the Mila ceremony? How do we refer to Mila? Do you recall, Moshe? You're the most recent one of us who had a bris. Chosem bris kodesh. Or that was I before you. I forget. Chosem bris kodesh. What does that mean? What is chosen? The seal or signature? The signature of the Holy Covenant. And what is it that about a person that is most unique by which you can identify him?
Handwriting.
Or what are the binds to?
Signature.
If the signature were not unique, the bank would never give you money on the signature because it would never know who it is. The fact is, when you sign, it's only your signature. There is no other such thing. It's an expression, therefore, of human individuality, of uniqueness. The bris is a chosem bris kodesh. It is a signature of the Holy Covenant. It means that the bris reaffirms Jewish loyalty to what? Again, to that which is utterly unique in the whole gestalt of the people. And what is it that is unique? What is it that's unique about Jews? Torah. Torah is the unique aspect. The whole commitment to the Ribono Shel Olam is what makes Eretz Yisrael unique too. It's not just a land for an ordinary land for an ordinary people. It's a land promised to a people because of a certain commitment. Sa'adya never tires of pointing out that we are a nation only by virtue of the Torah. But otherwise we are not a people. Mind you, we became a nation outside of Palestine. We became a nation outside of Palestine, and the Torah was given to us outside of Palestine. All of this motivates against the normalcy theory that we have to become a normal people. First, I doubt if the Jews ever will become a normal people. If they become a completely normal people, the whole dream of Zionism is defeated.
What do you mean by normal?
People like all other people. absolutely the same as other people's.
Other people's the same?
Well, in the same category. In other words, a nation like all other nations with nothing expressing an absolute uniqueness.
Well, each nation has its own national character.
Nice national characteristics. So the Italians eat spaghetti and play and are good musicians. The Greeks eat their food.
There is a national character. You can define it.
Yes.
And
what is this national
you
character?
You wouldn't call it normal.
No.
Because it is different.
But to reduce it to the same category of differentness. Look, you and I are different too. You're taller and I'm shorter. You have kinky hair and I have straight hair. So, does that make you unique? That's making you unique. It's a little different. You're normal and I'm normal, I hope. But uniqueness... What's that? Well, you know him too well, but... these are simply differences in the category of the normal. You have your personality, I have mine. But we still don't achieve uniqueness is in a higher category, it's a higher realm of it. It means something absolutely different. I'm not saying that the Jewish people always have to live in a glass. Well, maybe they do. Maybe we do, whether we like it or not. We do anyway.
We shouldn't throw stones.
What's that?
We shouldn't throw stones.
We shouldn't throw stones, but atom bombs is different. throwing stones is another thing. But certainly, whether we like it or not, the world looks upon us as a different people. And the whole idea of a special people created out of Abraham was not just to create another Levantine people. What? Yes, a Mamlecha Gadim V'am Kadosh means that the whole concept of the Torah about the nature of the Jewish people is far different from the nationalist, the pure nationalist goal. A far different interpretation of peoplehood. So that perhaps the story of Yishmael interrupts here, not only to show you that Yisrael is not this Zerah who would be included as the Bris Milah, the Zerah, the children of Bris Milah, but also to show you that Yishmael, as the Torah later expresses it, Ba'asher Husham. He was in the land until such a time as the land no longer held any promise for him. What did he do? He left. In other words, Yishmael failed to keep loyalty to the land of Israel. And throughout the ages, have the Arabs kept loyal to Palestine? The only time they covered Palestine was when the Jews got in. Until then, they had no interest in it.
But Abraham also left the land.
What's that?
Abraham also left the land.
Under divine command.
Ayira Boris.
Yes, but don't forget, that's the whole idea of Rashi, that was in Nisayim. See, but the Bris gives him a commitment to that land from now on. Even he conquered the land too. He conquered the land too. He went there as Lech Lecha, he conquered it. And he received a divine affirmation to it. Yitzchak comes back, his children come back, and his children long for it. They keep up their loyalty to it. Yishmael is destroyed by Golas. Once he leaves, he stays out. He goes into the desert. He has the same loyalty to Palestine that the Nisei have to Japan. They retain racial affinities to Japan, but they're complete Americans. As far as they are concerned, they have no relation to Japan whatsoever. Or the Irish to Ireland. The only time they have it is when they have this buffoonery of St. Patrick's Day. Otherwise, they have no real relationship to Ireland, or most of them don't. But the whole idea of Judaism is that the Zerah of Yitzchak, the children of Abraham through Yitzchak, do retain this utter loyalty to Eretz Yisrael because of the whole element of the unique quality of Torah, which makes Eretz Yisrael so much more important than just another country, which if it were only another country, we would never have to retain or never would retain this fanatic loyalty that we have retained, which can reassert itself after 2,000 years of dormancy. So this explains the breaking up of the two Brisim by the story of Yishmael. To show that for the Bris Ben Hapsarim to be effective, you have to have the kind of child who will have a devotion to the Chosen, to the uniqueness of Judaism. If you have the Chosen Bris Kodesh, a people who will retain the unique qualities of Avraham, they will remain loyal to Eretz Yisrael as promised in the first Bris. If you have a Yishmael who doesn't have the Chosen Bris Kodesh, who doesn't have the uniqueness of Abraham that he carries over, then he will not remain loyal to the Eretz Yisrael as is required in the first place.
When you talk about Eretz Yisrael, are you talking also about Medinat Yisrael that's there now? And if you are, how do you explain Israel religious rabbis appeal to So they shouldn't live there now. They shouldn't go there.
Well, that's a leading question, to say the least. Medina's Israel, I regard in a positive light. I regard it as a something obviously that God placed there. I don't regard it as the whole story. I agree with Rabbi Dovich, who said that it shouldn't have been called Israel, because the name Israel is reserved for the Jewish people. And the Jewish people are not exhausted by those who live in the city of Israel. But whatever it is called that, I don't think that this is the messianic redemption that Ben-Gurion thinks it is. Neither do I agree that it's simply a historic accident of tragic proportions that the Natura Kaida believes it is. My point of view, I suppose, would be mostly aligned with part of religious Zionism, though I'm not a party member by any means. But I would take the general attitude that this is definitely a sign of the recrudescence of this loyalty of Israel to the land, and this is the beginning. It's an opportunity, also a danger. Every opportunity, you know, is also a danger. The Chinese pictograph, the word for crisis, is composed of the two signs, one for opportunity, the other for danger. If you combine opportunity and danger in Chinese, you have the word crisis. Israel is now in a state of crisis, which means it has wonderful opportunities. From a long-range historical point of view, in great danger. And I speak not about being military.
Can I ask another leading question?
Another
answer. Are you seizing this opportunity by sitting in Williamsburg? Or anyone, I mean, these rabbis sit around Williamsburg. And there is an opportunity, there is a danger. It seems to me they're closing their eyes to both of them, just stay here.
Yes and no. I agree with you that we should have a much greater aliyah of religious people into Israel. There's no question about it. No question about it. If anyone possibly can go, they should go, by all means. But at the same time, I don't believe that we have no function to play historically vis-a-vis the state of Israel. I believe we have a great role to play, and not only that of a student sitting at the feet of a teacher. The idea of Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah Advar Hashem Yerushalayim is a messianic goal. Until then, it's possible that the state of Israel can learn a great deal from America. Of course, we have to build up America first. This happened in the past too. In the days of Babylon, Israel, or Palestine, the Chachamim and Israel, were merely students who sat at the feet of the teachers of Babylon. And Kimi Bobo, the Rebbeinu Tam, in the Middle Ages, writing about the Italian rabbis, and many of us don't realize we identify Italians as being the complete antithesis of Jews, you know. They are the Sicilian mobsters, and we are the Yidlach of the ghetto.
They're most like us.
But, huh? Very much so. But there is a great, great Jewish community in Italy and in Sicily. So much so that the Rabbeinu Tam, the grandson of Rashi, who lived in the 13th century in the Franco-German area, which was the heart and soul of one of the greatest Jews that ever lived, was moved to write about the Italian rabbis, Italian scholars, Ki mi atranto teitzei Torah, Udvar Hashem, Mibari, from Atronto and from Bari, the two great Italian centers of Judaism, he said Torah will go from there, and it did, for centuries. So that I'm not consigned, while I maintain we must have a positive attitude about towards Aliyah, and I'm not discussing the practical problems, of course they exist. And of course they must be overcome, and perhaps the Israeli Zionists are right. The Peace Corps will prove us. If our young men will now go to the Peace Corps, if they will go to Palestine, to Eretz Israel, it will prove at least the beginning of a good sign. If they don't, it proves the bankruptcy of American Zionism. But I believe that we have a positive role to play vis-a-vis Israel. How, what, why, or when is too much of a leading answer. But we'll leave that for some other time.